WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Ambivalent Zen, begins with this paradoxical saying, "Nothing removes man further from God than the desire for union with him." Lawrence Schoenberg's new memoir about practicing Zen meditation is filled with paradoxes and, as the title suggests, with conflicted feelings. Lawrence Schoenberg learned that Zen can set you free, free you up, help you let go. But if you get attached to those goals, you will try too hard and merely become tense and self-conscious. Zen meditation is about learning to quiet the analytic mind, a near impossible goal for a neurotic Western writer like Schoenberg. In fact, Schoenberg is so fascinated by the human mind, he's written two books about how the brain works, one a biography of a neurosurgeon, the other a novel about amnesia. He's been practicing meditation at a zendo or zen center since the 70s. I asked him to describe sitting meditation.
Well, sitting meditation is very simple. I mean, some people have called it idiot practice. You know, you sit and pay attention to your mind. There are various strategies brought to bear on that. One, the earliest, the most beginning strategy in Zen is counting your breath. You count in exhalations usually until you get to 10, and then you start at 1 again. The main point of it is that when your mind wanders, as it certainly it does, it tends to fly in the face of that kind of concentration, not to blame yourself, but just to go on back to one and continue counting your breath. In that sense, you could say it's a practice in forgiveness, because whatever your mind is doing is what's important at that time.
But the idea when you're sitting is that you're not supposed to be thinking a lot of thoughts. You're supposed to watch the thoughts go by, but not get involved with them.
Right. We say, don't chase after them. Pay attention to your thoughts, but don't chase after them. It's a very dangerous thing to come to it with any sort of idea. A lot of people come to it with the idea that they should empty their minds or be purified and compassionate while they're sitting on the cushion in order to continue that when they get up. But basically, you're just paying attention to whatever you are at that moment. The Buddha talked about the middle way as the basic principle of Buddhism. It's a moderation between extreme asceticism and extreme indulgence. And the same principle happens on the cushion. You try to pay attention to your thoughts, but not indulge them.
Meditation is in part about quieting the mind, about trying to quiet that endless chatter in the mind. Now, you're a writer, so what you do is observe things, think about them, describe them in words. Give me a sense of some of the frustrations you've faced while sitting in meditation. As a writer, as somebody whose mind is always going, always thinking, always describing.
it's a gossip mind, you know, a commenting mind that you're trying to register what you're going to register what's happening and remember it in order to use it later. You could say it's gossip. The mind that led to this book, in a certain sense, is a very distracting mind on the cushion. But that happens to be the mind that my experience has developed in me, so I have to make use of it.
A while ago when you were, I guess this is much earlier, when you were first learning to do sitting meditation, you were so, I think, at war with that voice in your head that's always chattering, the voice you were trying to silence during meditation, that you took 15 years' worth of your journals and took them to the dumpster and destroyed them.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
I wonder if it's great or something you really regret.
I never regretted it. It was a great liberation. I regretted that I wasn't able to kill my diary writing habit. As you know from the book, I almost immediately started writing another one. But it was just a total self-indulgence, that diary. It was a kind of masturbation. And it was necessary when I did it I think of a diary as a kind of a painkiller. And it's, you know, like any other painkiller, sometime you need it, but you pay a price for it. And I think I paid a great price for keeping a diary then and now.
Well, how is it a painkiller, and what was the price that you paid?
It's the painkiller of any sort of analytic mind. You're kind of creating another, you're creating explanation. You're hooked on the drug of explanation, and it doesn't lead to anything but more need for more explanation or more confusion, in my view, and I think safe to say in the view of Zen. It was costly in the sense that it just generated more self-consciousness, and I don't think it helped me at all.
So you threw it out, you felt good afterwards, and then you started writing another journal.
Right.
So what's the point?
The point is that some diseases are incurable.
And did the nature of what you were writing in the journal change?
I think it's changed. It's maybe become a little more elegant or sophisticated or spiritual, but it's still a junk, in my opinion.
But you're still doing it.
Yep. Sorry to say, you know, I'm not the first person that Zen didn't make perfect.
Now, you told your Zen teacher that you feared that writing and sitting meditation were incompatible. And your teacher gave you this advice. He said, well, when you're sitting, just sit. And when you're writing, just write.
Yeah.
That sounds really good, but that's really hard, isn't it?
That's about the hardest thing in the world. And it's the essence of his teachings and probably of all Zen teachers. He said a great thing to me one day. When I was going through this conflict about between Zen and writing, I would go to the Zendo and have these ecstatic periods of meditation and come back. And the more ecstatic I felt, the less I was able to work. And I told him about it, and he said, sure, your problem is you're attached to emptiness. You're not at your desk. When you go to your desk, you're still in the Zendo. And I think that's a great problem with many Zen students I've known. They become attached to this vision of emptiness, which becomes, it's a complete contradiction, because emptiness is not a, you can only be attached to forms, you can't be attached to emptiness. So immediately you're contradicting emptiness by becoming attached to some idea of it.
The literature of Zen Buddhism is filled with wonderful stories about Zen teachers. And I'd like to hear a little bit about your teacher. He's somebody who was a monk in Japan at the age of 6. He lived for a monastery in 17 years, spent 13 years in Israel, then moved to New York. How did you find him as a teacher?
You know, the Zen world is a very small one, and there are not many of these guys around. You know, there's a handful of Zen masters alive today. So when I was practicing, I mean, we all knew about him, that there was this guy in Israel, in the Arab quarter of Jerusalem, and he had a little Zendo there, and I had heard some great things about him, and I just had an instinct to go and meet him. And from the time I met him, actually, I thought that he embodied Zen more than any other teacher I had encountered. When I saw him there, I didn't expect I would ever see him again, but he turned up here in New York. He just decided to leave Israel and open a Zendo here. And from the time he got here, I was with him. I mean, I was studying with him.
When you say he embodied Zen, what does that mean?
Well, what you just said about his offering me that teaching of just sit. When you're on your cushion, just sit. When you're writing, just write. To me, it's a wonderful idea, and any Zen teacher, for that matter, any beginning Zen student knows it. But when you meet somebody like this, to me, he embodies that principle. He seems to be just doing whatever he's doing. If he's having a cup of tea, he's just having that cup of tea. When he's talking to you, he's just talking to you. It's a kind of, it can be a little disconcerting. Because he has, he's an amazingly concrete person, and he's got a kind of an energy that can be disturbing if you're not ready to hang in with him. You know, if you're not equally present with him, or if you want to get into some kind of conceptual discussion of Zen, he's not available for it at all.
You mean he doesn't intellectualize it?
Not at all. No, he's not. He's hasn't got that inclination. Some Zen teachers are quite brilliant at intellectualizing it, but he's not.
No, he was in some ways very strict with you. Do you think that's fair to say? Strict with his students?
I don't know about that. He was, the more he liked you, the more rough he could be, sometimes even brutal, in terms of calling your bluffs or trying to penetrate whatever
defenses
or pretentiousness is or pieties. Zen mm-hmm. tends to generate a lot of piety and unfortunately pretentiousness, I think, in people. And he was great at puncturing that.
Can you give me an example?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a story in my book of a point soon after he got here when I was sitting on my own in my own home, and I thought I had a pure enlightenment experience, what in Zen practice is called Kensho. And it was, ecstatic, very immediate, a sense that all, that my mind was suddenly clearer than it had ever been. I was very excited by it. So I did something I'd never done before. When I got up from the cushion, I called him. And I described this whole experience to him, and he listened to me patiently. And then I think I knew already that I'd made a huge mistake. And he said, listen to me. He said, in the word Buddha, even the letter B is nothing but dust. And, in other words, it's just another stain on your mind. And that all this stuff that I was giving him was what I think would be called Zen stink. I was holding on to this kind of, holding on to a sensation. That's not what Zen is about. But I was trapped in it for the moment, and he got me out of it, and I felt very, at that moment, very resentful of him, because he was taking something nice away from me. But it was good. It's a great help.
Yeah, and in contemporary parlance, he wasn't being supportive.
That's right. He's not supportive at all, and he can be, really, really much more brutal than that.
You, I think, are probably genetically skeptical.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is a problematic trait to have, I think. So the impression I get is when you were studying with your Zen teacher, that on the one hand, you'd be in his thrall. On the other hand, there'd always be part of you standing back and being really skeptical. Do you think that stood in your way, or that was a decent trait to have?
I think it helped me. It kept me from... it made my commitment to him, I think, a little more intelligent rather than romantic. There's always a great danger in these practices that you're getting into your own neurotic dreams of salvation, being saved by this perfect guy out there who's not suffering like you're suffering, who's not ignorant like you're ignorant. And my own skepticism made me look at him, distance myself from him enough so that I could, I think, meet him on a more solid ground. It also, as the book makes clear, I think it saved me from some teachers who finally weren't really helping me.
I'd like to hear about some of those other teachers and how they weren't helping you.
Let me back up from that. Yeah. I think they helped me in some ways. Mm-hmm. There's certainly no teacher that I describe in the book that I'm not grateful to, mm-hmm. that didn't give me a lot. But you get to a certain point, and you're either going to keep going and remain committed to them, or see that this is, it's like a love relationship almost, and sometime it has to end. There's a great danger in these practices that because they require a surrender of your own ego is the first step toward opening your own mind to a teacher. Then they tend to generate a lot of self-effacement in the student and a lot of egomania and even sadism in some teachers who aren't mature enough to handle that kind of power. It doesn't mean that they are monsters or that they are completely, complete charlatans. but that some just, you have to, they have to be really mature to handle the kind of power that students are going to invest in them.
My guest is Lawrence Schoenberg, and he's written a new memoir called Ambivalent Zen about his Zen studies and about sitting in meditation. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lawrence Schoenberg. He's a writer, and for many years he's been practicing Zen Buddhism, sitting in meditation. He has a new memoir called Ambivalent Zen. Now, your father was a wealthy businessman. He owned a chain of stores in the South that sold clothes and cheap cosmetics and shoes and boots and things like that. And your teacher once said to you that your problem was you were a rich man's son, you lived a life of luxury. The implication here is that you never had to do anything you didn't want to do.
Right.
And that here you were, 49 years old, and you were still wandering around like a baby. Was that a good analysis?
Yeah, I think it was right on the button. I couldn't argue with him. It was also why I was going to that cushion and trying to sit. You know, I think I recognized some of the costs, the softness that my own affluent upbringing had generated, had engendered in me. So I was doing the best I could to counter it.
What were the costs?
Well, I think it made me very spoiled and arrogant in a lot of ways. And on a most concrete level, it gave me a low pain threshold. My tolerance for pain when I started Zen was very low, and if Zen gave me anything, it was in challenging that.
Do you think because you didn't have to have a job and make a living that it gave you too much time to think, and that reflection became too much of an obsession?
It's something I think about all the time. I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. I know that obsession is very strong in me. I don't know that. I have, or people who have money have, any particular monopoly on it. One thing it certainly shows you is that material good fortune, like I've had, is not going to do anything about your fundamental suffering. If it made it possible for me to pay too much attention to my mind, I'm not sure. I know that in my own view, relatively speaking, I pay too much attention to my mind.
Right. Well, it maybe made it possible for you to not do things that would deflect your attention from your mind.
That's true.
In other words, you weren't forced to work. You weren't forced.
Well, that's what Roshi was. That's what he was trying to say. And he was always teasing me or pushing me about that. It's possible, but in some ways, maybe I as a writer, for example, it made me work harder, made mm-hmm. me more compulsive. As a writer, I think I've had a habit of being too much driven by too much driven to prove myself against that.
Given all the frustrations you've had in sitting meditation, why have you never given it up? Why have you never just said, "Well, this isn't working. It's not for me. I'm not suited"?
Because ultimately it makes more sense to me than anything. I can't imagine my life without it. It just, it's a very, very powerful, wonderful practice. And the impulse of the mind, I think in general, but certainly of my mind, toward escape, toward anesthesia, say, of killing your pain, avoiding your pain, denying it, is demonic, and you need all the help you can to defeat that impulse. And Zen is just one, it's not the only way, obviously, but it's a great, powerful practice against that impulse to escape.
Where are you now in your Zen studies?
The same place. I still do it. Roshi's being in Japan has our center is very small, and we just go there and sit on our own. We treat it like a gym, and it's something I do every day. It's like brushing my teeth, maybe an 45 minutes to an hour a day, or some days more, but that's generally the minimum.
Why do you go to a Zen center to sit in meditation? Why not just do it at home?
That's a great question. It's an important question. Zen is a communal practice. It's a, you get a lot from sitting with others. You get energy. Also, when you sit alone, as of course one does, you become very vulnerable to a kind of self-importance, and again, the same old romantic trips, the ego trips, you start to think you're something, there's something special about doing this practice. If you go there, sit around and you see a lot of schleps who look just like yourself, it's sort of hard to think it's anything special.
Lawrence Schoenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lawrence Schoenberg is the author of the new memoir, Ambivalent Zen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.